Welcome to the ISF Podcast from the Information Security Forum. The ISF Podcast is hosted by ISF CEO Steve Durbin, and every episode he brings listeners features timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. In today's episode, Steve is in conversation with Deborah Wheeler, CISO at Delta Airlines, based in Atlanta, Georgia. Debbie talks about her journey through the cybersecurity industry and offers her perspective on how the industry can be more open to women. She and Steve also discuss the difference between compliance and security and touch on how COVID has changed Delta's approach to hiring and personnel management.
So, Debbie, great to have you on the podcast. Thank you very much for joining me today. I'd like to start with a fairly sort of broad invitation, really, for you to sort of tell us your story. What was your path to becoming the CISO at Delta?
I think my path to security was accidental. Things right. Just kind of took off from there. So I started out as an engineer working for a telecommunications company.
Okay.
And I had the opportunity while I was working at that company to do a special project. My boss came to me one day and said, hey, you know, some of our development assets are plagued by a virus, this virus stuff. I don't know what this is about. Can you go figure out what these things are and what we need to do about it? And I said, sure. And so that kind of started me down this path of being interested in security. I researched what was available at the time and came back with a recommendation and a project plan. And 6 weeks later, we had deployed antivirus software to all of our development stations in the US, and then it gradually went global. And I became known as the quote unquote virus lady.
Right.
I knew all things about viruses. But from that point, anything that remotely looked like or smelled like security came my way. My next project was to create a security policy. And then after that, to remove unused accounts from all of our technology assets at this telecommunications company, which was MCI at the time. And my interest grew as I was given more and more activities and trusted with more responsibility in this emerging space of what we now call cybersecurity. My next role was as a network architect, a security architect. And then from that point on, everything I did for the remainder of my career has been security focused, cybersecurity focused. So I started in the early 90s, and you know, here we are in 2022, and I've never done anything but cybersecurity, information security, privacy-related activities. From a CISO perspective, most of my career was spent in the financial services sector. And at one point, I had the opportunity to take on the CISO role for a bank in my hometown.
Right.
And it was the opportunity for me to return back home after 16 years of moving to other cities in the U.S. And I took that role, and that was kind of the start of my evolution as a CISO. And ultimately, how I wound up here at Delta.
I was going to say, and so then why Delta? Why did you decide to move out of, as you said, financial services into aviation?
Well, two reasons. First and foremost, I love the build process. I love building security programs. And when this job opportunity presented itself to me, it was as a build or a rebuild of a security program. So that was very attractive to me. And secondly, I really wanted to get out of financial services. At least here in the United States, it's a heavily regulated industry. And I found myself doing things to check boxes and not doing things for the sake of security. And that wasn't a place I wanted to be anymore. I wanted to actually be practicing security and doing things for the right reasons and not just to check compliance boxes.
But some people listening to this may be thinking to themselves, well, aviation's pretty regulated, isn't it? So, I mean, obviously not as much as financial services, but how do you square that one?
It is very regulated. Historically, it's been very regulated on the side of physical security and safety. We are now starting to see more and more regulation being proposed and introduced around cybersecurity. but we're not at a point where it's a checkbox exercise, right? And hopefully the aviation sector has learned from the financial services sector that there has to be an element of creativity in how we go about security, because threat actors are moving very rapidly and they're able to change tactics much faster than we're able to change our tactics. And if our primary concern is about being able to check a compliance box versus responding to a threat, we're going to be in a world of hurt. So I like the idea. I like the fact that while we are definitely seeing additional regulation in cybersecurity entering the aviation space, it has not yet achieved that element of you just need to demonstrate you can do these things. We don't care about anything else. Just do these things. And that checklist is not yet so long that we have no time to do anything else.
I think that's a really interesting perspective. I mean, my view has, which has got me into trouble from time to time, is that I'm not a fan of compliance at all within the security space, because, you know, good compliance does not equal good security, whereas good security, you're in with a chance of actually having pretty good compliance coming out of that. But I have a real concern as we continue to sort of lurch towards what everybody tells us is going to be yet another recession, that budgets will inevitably be cut. And we all know what that means from a security standpoint. Boards, business leaders, tend to fall back on compliance first because that's what I have to do, and security second. Is that a concern of yours, or do you think we've gone past that now?
It is not a concern for me. And here's why. Compliance and security do not have to be at odds with each other. I do think some degree of regulatory oversight and compliance is required to create a baseline of best practices across industry. Where I think we get wrapped around an axle from a compliance perspective is when that becomes the predominant conversation and not security for the sake of ensuring we're secure. I don't think that they are mutually exclusive, and I don't think that a recession should impact good security. There's plenty we can do without incurring significant cost to an organization. But it requires resource. It requires people in the organization already there, already supporting those assets, to have a focus on the security aspect of supporting those assets. So if I'm a developer today responsible for supporting an application, I just need to expand my thinking and maybe my responsibilities to also include what is entailed in securing that application, in keeping it patched. And maybe you've got a backlog or what we call tech debt that has to be remediated before you can get to a point where maintaining the security of the application is not as heavy of a lift as some organizations perceive, because they've neglected doing some of that patching or some of that application maintenance over time. That's where I think the discussion goes around the cost of security, is when we see organizations with very, very heavy tech debt because they've focused more on the innovation than they have focused on innovating and maintenance. And it's almost, it's got to be kind of cycles, right? You can innovate, but you also have to maintain what you've innovated.
And again, some people listening to this may think, well, that's great. Debbie's obviously in an organization that's relatively mature from understanding that sort of thing. But if I'm a CISO listening to this in an organization that perhaps does not have that level of maturity, that is still seeing security in a perhaps more siloed way, what sort of advice and guidance would you have for them as to how they could move to the sort of environment that you're now talking about?
Well, I think it starts with an honest conversation with whoever is in charge of technology. Most CISOs, at least 50% based on statistics, report up through the CIO or the CTO of their respective organization. So I think sitting down and having a conversation with that individual about, you know, how can we both achieve the objectives we both have before us, right? The CIO or CTO is going to have one set of goals and objectives from a productivity perspective or an innovation perspective. And the CISO has a separate set of goals and objectives. You've got to figure out how you marry the two. And if you're in a situation where you cannot marry the two, or where it's very obvious you're not going to make the progress, then I think you've got to make a tougher decision about whether that's the right organization to stay in. And I've made that decision throughout my career, right? There are some organizations that get it. Mm-hmm. They've seen their neighbor or they've seen another company in the industry sector become a victim, whether that's to a ransomware attack or to some other form of cyber attack. And they have seen where maybe less than ideal security practices were the root cause of that. And they've decided that they don't want that to happen to them. And they're going to make that investment. And it starts with hiring someone to be responsible for security. And by responsible, I mean helping that organization understand from a strategic perspective and a roadmap perspective, the work that they need to do to get to a more secure state. And they're willing to invest in that. And I've been part of organizations that don't want to do that. You know, they want to talk about it. They don't want to take the time, make the investment, or take the steps necessary. And I don't stay. And I would encourage other CISOs to consider whether or not staying is the best use of your talent or moving to an organization that's willing to hear what you have to say and engage with you and invest in your program might be a better use of your time and talent.
And let's face it, we are lucky enough, I think, to work in an industry where there is no shortage of opportunity, right? So, in fact, we have the opposite problem, you know, trying to encourage more and more people into the industry. How have you tackled that at Delta? How have you attracted more people into the industry?
Well, I think, you know, we have the pandemic to thank in some ways for this shortage of talent, because I think over the course of the pandemic, we saw cybercrime escalate. Right. Whether it was ransomware attacks or phishing and monetary loss through phishing, we came out of the pandemic, so to speak, with a variety of industries suddenly seeking the expertise of cybersecurity professionals in ways we hadn't seen prior to the pandemic. So now we have this talent shortage. The way we're addressing it here is it's kind of multifaceted, right? We work really hard to keep our existing people happy. And I think Delta does a phenomenal job with employee engagement and employee satisfaction. But we also recognize we've got to develop the next generation of cyber talent. So the way that we do that is we today work with a high school here in the Atlanta area that has a work study program. And we employ a group of those students to work alongside members of my team, learning the trade, so to speak. They're learning cybersecurity skills. They're learning the best practices. They're learning about the regulation that governs our industry and how to respond from a compliance perspective to that regulation. And our hope in making that investment is that maybe one or two students a year will be interested enough in the field that post high school, they will enroll in a cyber program in college, or they'll continue to develop their skills outside of college and maybe come back to us as a future employee. We also work with and talk with organizations that maybe are not the typical organizations to speak with about procuring cyber talent, but they're training cyber expertise without the need for the four-year degree. And so we're working alongside some of those programs as well. City of Refuge here in Atlanta is one such program that we have hired some phenomenal talent through, and not necessarily folks that have a four-year degree. And I think that's the other probably big pivot we made coming out of the pandemic is really looking at and evaluating how many of our jobs require a four-year college degree to execute well, and how many of those opportunities could we give to someone either graduating high school, but really interested in cybersecurity and maybe has gone the route of getting some certifications on their own. How many of those are roles we could give to somebody who's done two-year degrees or maybe has gone through certificate programs? So we're looking at all of that as a way and a means to develop and onboard emerging cyber talent.
I think there's some really interesting approaches that you've adopted there, because I was talking to a CISO just the other day who was saying to me, you know, that his company in particular has invested in supporting the local university. And one of the complaints he had was that, but that means you've got to wait 4 years. So it's really interesting to hear you say that actually we can shorten that, because if we're smart about this, we can figure out who needs to have got that additional learning, but also what roles do we need to fill today that people who haven't gone that full distance could perhaps help us close. So I think that's a really interesting takeaway for people listening to this. One of the other things that I did want to ask you was, because I get asked this question a lot, is how is it possible to manage security consistently across a large geographic spread? Now, Delta has something like, I don't know, 80,000 employees, I think, and you operate in 50 to 60 different countries. I think I've got that right. How do you cope with ensuring security across all of that different geographic spread?
Oh, that's a great question, and I'm not sure I have a great answer. I think we do our best, right?
Right.
We monitor our network heavily. We engage with our business units anytime they want to introduce new technology to the organization. We engage with the vendors to understand what security they've implemented around their solutions or their connectivity or their services. We do our best. And I think like any large corporation, you do your best with what you have. And so we try. A big part of that is awareness. So I would emphasize that trying to keep our workforce educated on the topic of cybersecurity is one of our top five areas of emphasis and investment. And we rely on our people to have that knowledge and understand the threats that may be directed at them and the role that they play in helping us to secure the broader organization. So you mentioned our 80,000 plus employees. We try and co-opt each and every one of them and require training of them on cybersecurity topics every year in the hopes that if we continue to invest in their education and awareness around the threat, that they will do the right things with the assets that they have at their disposal.
Talking about threats, what are some of the biggest threats that you see emerging at the moment?
I think the nation state threat is one that, you know, we spend a great deal of time talking about and monitoring for. But there are a lot of hacktivist groups. There are a lot of individual actors, organized crime. I think it's the same for any large organization. You're going to be an attractive target to a variety of criminals. And that's what we're dealing with, certainly.
And that sort of leads me down to risk appetite, I guess. You know, risk management is obviously a huge part of what any and every airline has got to consider. I'm sure Delta's no exception to that. And there's always an awareness as well that the physical safety of so many people often depends on how you go about doing your business. Now, given all of that, how has Delta set about establishing its risk appetite? And then second to that, what role have you had in setting Delta's levels of risk tolerance?
It's a great question. And I think for every organization, risk appetite and risk tolerance are things that are constantly evolving and being discussed. I would say we don't have a defined risk tolerance. We know what we don't want to have happen, and we're pretty clear about that. And we take the necessary steps, make the necessary investments to prevent certain risks from occurring. But we also are realistic about the things that exist outside of our ability to control for them. And we will do what we can to mitigate that risk as much as we can, but maintain, you know, kind of a realistic mindset about it. So as an example, I can't prevent a phishing campaign from occurring and potentially being responded to by one of our employees. But I can take necessary steps to reduce the likelihood of that phishing campaign getting through to my employees. And I can take the steps to educate my employees about phishing and hopefully give them tools they can use to prevent themselves from becoming a victim. But can I guarantee that at 100%? No, I can't. And our board of directors and our senior leadership knows that, right? So I think when you're talking about risk appetite, it's an ongoing conversation and ensuring that senior leaders and the board understand the risks as we see them evolving and changing and the steps we're taking to mitigate those risks, to educate our employee population about those risks. And if they don't feel that we're doing enough or that our actions are inadequate, then certainly, you know, the investment discussion follows on.
I'm interested to hear how you think your board and your senior leaders, their view of security has perhaps changed over the last 4 to 5 years? Because this is something, again, that a lot of people say to me, you know, how do I get that buy-in from the top? How can I get them to understand the implications of cyber and not just technology? It's actually fundamental to the business.
So I am very fortunate to have a cyber expert that sits on our board of directors. I understand not all companies have that luxury, but the Delta board made that decision many years before I arrived at Delta. And so we have a cyber expert that sits on our board. And the advantage for me is not only is he an advocate, obviously, of the things we do in the cyber program space, but he also knows the questions to ask. And he's going to make sure that he's asking those questions and he's making sure his peers on the board understand the question as well as the answer. And he's going to challenge. If he doesn't think we're doing enough or we're looking in the right spaces, or if he's got questions about other risks and whether or not we believe that they are impactful to the airline, he's not afraid to ask those questions. And I love that, right? I love it because, one, it gives me opportunity to talk about, here are some things we're watching, here are some things we're concerned about, but here are some proposed mitigations. Do you feel we're going down the right path? Or might be, I think we are going down the right path and here are the reasons why. Right. But there's conversation. And I think that is really, really valuable to me as a CISO. I'd much rather have a conversation, even if I'm being questioned, than to have a board of directors with no expertise present just accept everything you say at face value. I think that's dangerous for the board. It's dangerous for the company.
It does make life a heck of a lot easier, doesn't it? Because you can, as you say, have that conversation. You aren't just reporting back to a board. You can have dialogue. You can, to a certain extent, you know, have a very robust discussion about the direction you should be headed in. And I think that is, again, really what a lot of people listening to this would think of as being their ideal endpoint. And I think it is changing. I think certainly if I go back, you know, just a few years, the number of boards that didn't have that level of expertise was certainly more then than it is now. So I think we are seeing a shift there, but it is slow moving, I think, in a lot of industries. Talk to me about some of the trends that you see emerging in security. What excites you?
Oh my, what excites me? Very little, to be honest. very little.
And there are probably people listening to this thinking, well, thank goodness for that. You know, she's the CISO of one of the biggest airlines in the world. We don't want her getting too excited about things. It's keep our feet on the ground here.
You know, I think one of the things that frustrates me, it might be easier to talk about that. From a tech perspective, we just see a lot of new technology being introduced that's an iteration of existing tech, right? And we're not seeing, I'm not seeing, personally speaking, a lot of creative thought going into some of the new tech that's being introduced. On the flip side, some of the things I'm watching carefully right now, obviously API security solutions that are coming out. Saw an interesting one presented at a conference I attended last week for authenticating APIs. So we're watching that. Obviously, zero trust architecture. Mm-hmm. With so many organizations moving to the cloud, it'll be interesting to see how many of those truly adopt the zero trust model. Those are probably the two things I wouldn't say I'm excited about them, but they are intriguing to me and I'm watching.
And what would you like to see, if anything, change in the security industry? You know, if I could give you a magic wand and said, you know, change something, what would you pick out?
Automated patching solutions that, you know, you push a button, it tests in your environment and automatically pushes once everything's been verified and can do all of that in under 24 hours. Now, that would get my attention. And that would certainly be something I'd invest in. But I've been waiting too long for that one. But if I had a magic wand, yeah, that's what I would do. Yeah. I'd wave it. Everything would be patched. We wouldn't need to expend the energy and the resources on the people that have to do all of that work manually today.
And that, of course, you know, patching is, as you said, it's the bane of every security department's life. They really would rather have a much more simple solution than the one that unfortunately exists. And the bad guys know that. And that's how we see some of the routes into to attack, isn't it? Debbie, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. But I can't let you go, though, without just asking you one final question. We touched on the fact that it's difficult to perhaps attract the right skill sets into our industry. I'm looking at our annual World Congress coming up, and whilst we've made some improvements in terms of the splits of people that we see coming to that, you know, we're probably going to have about a third of all of our attendees who are women. And the industry is clearly suffering from still a lack of women. Cyber is still a male-dominated industry. And so I think that it is an industry, therefore, that is losing some of the richness that you get from increasing the amount of diversity that you have in teams. So speak for a moment to the women who perhaps aspire to become security leaders. What are some of the things that you think they could do? And on the other side of that, what is it that the majority of men in the space could also do to help open things up a little bit more?
I think for the women, don't give up, right? It can be difficult being the only female in a room full of men. It can be difficult being one of the only women at a conference full of men. Don't give up, right? That would be the biggest piece of advice that I can give, because there are many times in my career where going into those situations, I had to, you know, think twice, do I really want to be in this field? Is this really right. something I want to do? But the mission is what kept me going. So think beyond your gender and how uncomfortable being the only one of your gender in the room may make you feel. And think about why. What's your why? Focus on your why. For the men, I think one of the greatest gifts men can give to women is a voice. I have been in so many situations, and I have seen female peers in so many situations where they get talked over, where their ideas get co-opted by an outspoken male counterpart. And it's frustrating. And it's one of the reasons why a lot of women will shy away or choose to leave a field that is heavily male dominated, because they don't feel like they're listened to, or that their opinion or their ideas matter. So I think one of the greatest things that men can do for women pursuing technology careers in general is listen and give them a voice. If you see a male counterpart talking over a female in the room, stop. Stop them and say, hey, you know, Susan had something to say. Can we give her the floor? Mm-hmm. Or if you see her idea being co-opted by another individual in the room, stop the conversation and be willing to say, hey, let's back up, because Susan had a really great idea and I think so-and-so might be expanding on it, but could we go back to Susan and ask her what she meant by that, right? Just give them the voice that they're willing to bring to the table. Give them the space to share their ideas and give them the opportunity to express them, to have that voice.
And indeed, as somebody who works with a predominantly female management team, I can certainly echo some of the value that you get from having such diverse teams, because you do get a different perspective. And that, mm-hmm. for me anyway, can only be a good thing. So thank you very much, Debbie, for sharing some of those insights. Thank you for talking about some of the work that you do at Delta, and again, offering up some advice to people listening to this who perhaps are not in such an advanced, mature state as you are. I'm sure everybody listening to this will have taken away a number of different points. So thank you very much indeed for that. Been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Steve. Likewise.
Thanks again to this week's guest, Debra Wheeler of Delta Airlines. We'll be back with a new episode in a week. In the meantime, as always, we ask that you take 10 seconds to pull up this podcast on whatever device you're listening and give us a 5-star rating. If you have a little more time, you can even write a quick review. That helps other listeners who might enjoy our content find us. And we also want to make sure to introduce you to the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, which goes in depth on the hottest topics in information security. In every episode, ISF analysts hand-select active security professionals from ISF member organizations to discuss how the implementation of ISF research is uniquely applied to their real-world context. We hope you'll listen, and of course, we'll put a link to that show in our show notes. If there's a topic or a question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode, let us know at securityforum.org. Which is also where you can find our catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. The ISF podcast is produced by TalkBox and Tavia Gilbert, with music by Alexander Filipiak, senior producer Katie Flood, mix and master by Kayla Elrod. Thanks for listening.